The Handwriting of God, talk by Elder A.T. Jones, Thursday, 8 a.m., February 23, 1899. We will look at the second part of the book of Daniel this morning. As I said at the beginning, all we can do at the most is merely sketch the book. I believe that all can begin to see now that when we go forth asking the wisdom of God and the Spirit of God to enable us to preach the books of Daniel and Revelation, that will give a power to our work that has not yet been seen in it. Not simply will we present the lines of prophecy in the book, but the glorious principles of it, taking the book as a whole and setting it before the people. They will see how it presents, they will see how it pictures the present times and what principles it gives to save men in the present times. What could be better? See, has not the Lord framed for us the shape that the preaching of the message should take as regards the prophecies, the times in which we live, the signs of the times and all? This part of the book is quite familiar to all, yet I do not hesitate to begin a lesson on this part of the book because I know that in those scriptures with which we are really the most familiar, we shall always be able to see yet more. As I remarked toward the beginning of these studies, the first half of the book is a treatise on principles only. The last half of the book is the illustration drawn out over and over of that great truth of the book. The Most High ruleth in the kingdom of man and giveth it to whomsoever he will. We found that principle embodied and fairly embedded in the first half of the book, and the second half is simply a great illustration of that truth. Look at the first symbol in the seventh chapter. Quote, "The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it." Close quote. That is the whole history of Babylon. I do not say that it is a symbol of the history. It is the history itself written up. First, look at a lion as he stands. Was he in the world of beasts? King. What was Babylon in the world of kingdoms? The glory of kingdoms. The greatest of kingdoms. The golden one. Yet that does not tell at all. He had eagle's wings. What is the eagle in his realm? King. That was Babylon during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar when it was in the height of its glory. The wings were plucked. What do the wings signify? Celerity, quietness of movement, swiftness of conquest. When the wings were plucked, what does that signify? Loss of the rapidity of the conquest. That feature of the kingdom is lost. Not only that, but the lion was made to stand in the attitude of a man. What does that say? E.G. Wagner in the audience said he lost his advantage. Jones replies, put a lion on his feet, standing upright as a man, and he is a lion no more. This is illustrated in the Bible by the story of David, a mere boy. When keeping the sheep, he saw a lion coming out against the sheep. He went out against it. The lion stood up as a man, and David grasped him by the beard and slew him. Of course, the Lord gave him the victory, but if that lion had not stood upright, he could have sprung upon David and torn him to pieces by one stroke of his paws. The kings of Assyria delighted in hunting lions. Whenever they got a lion on his feet as a man, it was all over with the lion. That tells the whole story of Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar's death. As long as he stood as a lion, he represented Babylon in its glory and strength. And the wings of the eagle indicated speed of conquest. But the wings were taken away. And the lion stood upright as a man. Not only that, but a man's heart was given him. That speaks of timidity, trembling, and fear. When such a heart is in a lion, and he is standing as a man, what is he then? the weakest, the most useless of beasts. Take up Nebuchadnezzar's history in the Bible, then read the history of the kings after him. There were four of them, or five, with Belshazzar, and the whole story is told in their experience. You read it in the history, but when you have read it all in the history, you see it there. Do you know any more than when you started? If you already know what the Bible says, no. You know the how of it, that is all. You can see the Lord at work, and you can see events coming in that demonstrate, illustrate, and make plain the statements of the Bible, but you do not find anything additional. I will not go into detail with all these things. I simply read that as an illustration to show how fully the history is written in the Bible itself. That is an illustration of practical use to the teachers in our schools. Church schools and all. The teacher in the church school, where there are children only 8 or 10 years old, that teacher can take the Bible, only the Bible, and teach the history of Babylon and Medo-Persia, Grecia, Rome, and the 10 kingdoms to those children without a single book of history if she knows the Bible. Take the Bible and a blackboard, or the Bible and a pencil and paper, if you have not a blackboard, and the history can be taught to the children, and they will understand it. For God's instruction and his methods of instructing are better than all the human that were ever constructed. Take a child and let him read that verse about the lion. If you have the picture of that lion, set it before him. Teach him what that says, as we have sketched it this morning. Then take a map and set it before the child. Show him the limits of the Babylonian Empire, and he has the whole history and understands it. Take the next symbol, and behold another beast, a second, like to a bear. And it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. From the 8th chapter of Daniel, we know that this kingdom pushed to the westward, the northward, and the southward. What then did the three ribs represent? The three directions of conquest. As he pushed westward and northward and southward, it is perfectly plain that he stood in the east, that is, Medo-Persia. The next is the leopard, having four heads. And then the great and terrible beast, diverse from all that were before it. Then the 10 kingdoms. The 8th and the 7th chapters are parallel so far. The he-goat comes from the west. The ram stands in the east and pushes westward. And the he-goat comes from the west so swiftly that he touches not the ground. Then what is going to happen? A collision. And in the collision, which fails? The ram. And the scriptures describe it. There is where has been a lack. We have not closely enough studied the very words that are in the Bible, word by word, to get what the word says and what is in that word. Again, I say to the teachers of our schools, church schools, and academies, get the history that is in the book of Daniel, and then you will have a splendid guide to all the history that is outside of the Bible, and you can go out there to get it when you need it. But no teacher need undertake to take a little child through these other histories. The Bible is for the little child. Let this be taught thoroughly to him while a child. And then, as years come upon him, he could go wherever he pleases, for he is perfectly familiar with it. He knows every step that is taken in it, and all the philosophy of it. He knows more than the man in the outside schools who may be teaching history. Daniel, in the school at Babylon, knew more of history than did all his teachers. He had the history that God had given in the writings of Moses, and the writings that are referred to in the Bible that we have not. Daniel knew more than all his teachers. Daniel knew the rise of Nimrod's kingdom. The Babylonian teacher could say, Nimrod was the first great king in our history. Nimrod founded this great kingdom and ruled over Babylon. But Daniel knew more than the teacher did on that subject. It is not essential that our children shall be led through all the books outside of the Bible. Read the history that is in the Bible for itself and get it, and then you have all the rest. Well, Grisha came in, that great he-goat. He came from the West. How did he come? He came from the West on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. He came so swiftly that he touched not the ground. But as he came on the face of the whole earth. Where did he start? Alexander started from Pila, right there. And Jones is pointing to the map. Now, I want you to follow this pointer as I trace his course so that you can see the whole history in that one clause, on the face of the whole earth. First, when Alexander became king, he went down to Corinth and was accepted there as the head of the Greeks. Then went back to his home at Pila, then up to and across the Danube and back again. Then up the Danube, subduing all the tribes in the countries toward the Arctic Sea. Then back again into Greece and down to Corinth. Thus he covered all this territory to the sea. Then he started again from Pila, crossed the Hellespont, and came out a few miles to the Granicus, where his first battle was fought. From there he went to Sardis. From there to Ephesus, from Ephesus to Miletus, and from Miletus over to Halicarnassus. That brought him down to the sea, and he went so entirely to the sea that he had to wade in the sea with his troops to get around the point called Climax. Then instead of keeping along the coast, he marched clear back north, nearly to the Black Sea, a little eastward again, then back down to the Mediterranean Sea again. At the northeast corner of the Mediterranean Sea was the Battle of Issus. That's where that was fought, his second great battle. From there he passed down the coast, sent a detachment over to Damascus, and took that, while he himself passed down to Tyre. Then he went up to Jerusalem to destroy that, with the results that I have read the other day. Then down to Gaza, and took that. Then down to Egypt, where he was welcomed, founded Alexandria, marched out into the desert of Ammon, where he was recognized as the son of the god. Back again to Alexandria, and through the body of Egypt, then out again, up by Damascus, way up north, across the Euphrates, across the Tigris, and down the Tigris River 3 or 4 days, until he met Darius's army at the Battle of Arbela. There the Persian Empire was destroyed. Then he passed down to Babylon, stayed a few days. From Babylon he went northward, and out to the eastward to Ecbatana, then up by the Caspian Sea, around between the mountains and the sea, and back again into Hyrcania, south eastward and southward, through Central Asia, back northward and northeastward into Scythia, conquered the Scythians, then back again southeastward across the river Indus, across the river Hydaspes, and on to the Hyphases. Then he turned back and went down both sides of the river Indus, clear to the sea. There his forces were divided. His fleet sailed to the Euphrates. Alexander took his army and went overland across to the capital of Persia, up again to Ecbatana, and down again to Babylon, where he died. How much did he cover? The whole. There was no earthly need of that, so far as anybody could see. The Battle of the Granicus gave him all Asia Minor, and all he needed to do was to march straight across to the Issus. The Battle of Issus gave him all west of the Euphrates. He could have gone straight east from there, and the Battle of Arbela gave him all the rest, but instead of that, he went round and round and over it all. Now I say, there was no military need of that. There was no need so far as man can see. But hidden in God's counsel, there was a great need of it all. In all this country, everywhere he went, he founded Greek colonies. leaving a few Greeks in a place. Thus, he spread the Greek language all over that region, and it was planted there and grew until the day when God wanted to send the gospel there in Greek. That is why he covered the whole earth. I say again, there was no military need of it. The only need of it was the true need, as in the counsel of God, the world's need of the gospel. Brother Prescott says to me that I did not get the ability to read those names and the ability to run this pointer around over the map all from the Bible. In a way, I did. I did not get from the Bible these actual names, but when the Lord said that a king came from the west upon the face of the whole earth, I must follow him. In the history, we find the complement of the sketch which God has given, and I did not consider that I was doing my part until I had followed that up as far as I could possibly learn, until I had drawn my own pen over that same track of history where Alexander went. After doing all that myself, it is now easy enough for me to take a pen or a pencil and draw it over any map showing where Alexander went. And brethren, you are not proper students until you have done all that yourself. Why should we go on year after year and not work this thing out for ourselves? You must know that for yourself, or you will not know the philosophy of it for yourself, and you cannot make it plain to other people. Voice in the audience says, Brother Jones, we all believe that was true, but Alexander must have had some motive in his mind for that. He did not think of the gospel coming. Now, what was the motive in Alexander's mind for doing that? Jones says, the motive in his mind was just to be a-going, to overcome every difficulty, to do everything that nobody had ever done, and to make the whole country Greek. He delighted in doing what it was considered could not be done. It was exploration. Also, as it was all new to the Greeks, none of them had ever been across into Asia. Mrs. S.M. I. Henry says, it's just the same thing that makes a boy climb a tree. And Jones says, that is it exactly. And another voice in the congregation says, I've heard it said that the Romans sent an embassy to Alexander. Is there any authority for that? Jones says, you have the authority of Grote, of the Britannica, and Arnold, three of the best in the world. I read all three. Page 182 of Great Empires of Prophecy, I will read these passages presently about Rome. All I attempted to do in this book, the book Great Empires of Prophecy, was to take the history as it is recorded in the best books and set it down here and then map it. Brother Prescott wants to know how I knew what to take and what to leave out. I knew it from the Bible. I had to go through more than 80 histories to get the history which is set down in this book for you and whoever else wants to read it there. Now, in answer to the question of whether Rome sent embassies to Alexander, I read, quote, there is every reason to believe that among the Tyrathenians, ambassadors mentioned by Alexander's historians, there were included ambassadors from Rome. History may allow us to think that Alexander and a Roman ambassador did meet at Babylon, that the greatest man of the ancient world saw and spoke with a citizen of that great nation which was destined to succeed him in his destined work and to form a wider and more enduring empire. They met too in Babylon, almost beneath the shadow of Bel. Perhaps the earliest monument ever raised by human pride and power in a city stricken, as it were, by the word of God's heaviest judgment, as the symbol of greatness apart from and opposed to goodness. During the period of Alexander's conquests, no other events of importance happened in any part of the civilized world, as if a career so brilliant had claimed the undivided attention of mankind. Close quote. Quote again. He knew that there were arrived in that city ambassadors from all parts of the world. who waited for his coming. The whole earth echoing so much with the terror of his name that the several nations came with inexpressible ardor to pay homage to Alexander as to him who was to be their sovereign, so that he set forward with all possible diligence toward that great city, there to hold, as it were, the States General of the world. So widely had the terror of his name and achievements been spread that several of these envoys came from the most distant regions. There were some from the various tribes of Libya, west of Egypt, from Carthage, west of Libya, from Sicily and Sardinia, from the Illyrians and the Thracians, and from the Lucanians, the Britons, the Tuscans in Italy, nay, even some affirmed, from the Romans, as yet a people of moderate power. But there were other names yet more surprising. Ethiopians, from the extreme south, beyond Egypt. Scythians, from the north, beyond the Danube. Iberians, from Spain and Gauls, from the far west, beyond the Mediterranean Sea. Legates also arrived from various Grecian cities, partly to tender congratulations and compliments upon his matchless successes, partly to remonstrate against his sweeping mandate for the general restoration of the Grecian exiles. It was remarkable that these Grecian legates approached him with wreaths on their heads, tendering golden wreaths to him as if they were coming into the presence of a god. The proofs which Alexander received, even from distant tribes, with names and customs unknown to him, of fear for his enmity and anxiety for his favor, were such as had never been shown to any historical person, and such an entirety to explain his superhuman arrogance. Close quote. This was from Grote, Jones says. Then he quotes again. In the 10th year, after he had crossed the Hellespont, Alexander, having won his vast dominion, entered Babylon. And resting from his career in that oldest seat of earthly empire, he steadily surveyed the mass of various nations which owned his sovereignty, and revolted in his mind the great work of breathing into this huge but inert body the living spirit of Greek civilization. In the bloom of youthful manhood, at the age of 32, he paused from the fiery speed of his earlier course, and for the first time have the nations an opportunity of offering their homage before his throne. They came from all the extremities of the earth to appropriate his anger, and to celebrate his greatness, or to solicit his protection. African tribes came to congratulate and bring presents to him as the sovereign of Asia. Not only the people bordering on Egypt upon the west look with respect on the founder of Alexandria and the son of Jupiter Ammon, but those who dwelt on the east of the Nile and on the shores of the Arabian Gulf would hasten to pay court to the great king whose fleets have navigated the Aetherian Sea and whose power was likely to affect so largely their traffic with India. Already the bravest of the barbarians of Europe were eager to offer him their aid, and the Celts and Iberians, who had become acquainted with Grecian service when they fought under Dionysius and Agelastus, sent ambassadors to the great emperor of Babylon, allured alike by the fame of his boundless treasures and his unrivaled valor. It was no wonder that the Carthaginians, who had dreaded a century earlier the far inferior power of the Athenians, and on whose minds Timoleon's recent victories had left a deep impression of the military genius of Greece, dispatched their ambassadors to secure, if possible, the friendship of Alexander. The Lucanians and Britannians are especially mentioned as having sent embassies to Alexander at Babylon. The Tirathenians also said, Aristotelus and Ptolemaeus sent an embassy to the king to congratulate him upon his reconquests. The ports of the western coast of Italy swarmed at this time with piratical vessels, which constantly annoyed the Greek traders in those seas. These piracies had been reported to Alexander, and he sent remonstrances to the Romans on the subject. There is every reason to believe that among the Tyrrhenian ambassadors mentioned by Alexander's historian, there were included ambassadors from Rome. Close quote. Here are two scenes, Jones says. Scene first. In the year 603 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, king of the mighty kingdom and builder of the wonderful city of Babylon, sits in his pleasant palace. Before him, and speaking earnestly, stands a young Jew. To the intently listening king, the young man is interpreting a remarkable dream that the great king had dreamed. He says that God is thus making known to the king what should come to pass afterward, and that one among these things would be the rise of a third kingdom, and that this third kingdom should bear rule over all the earth. Scene 2. 270 years afterward, in that great city of Babylon, perhaps in the same palace where Nebuchadnezzar had sat, there sits Alexander the Great, king of the third kingdom from Nebuchadnezzar. And he sits there upon his throne. Before him stand ambassadors from all the extremities of the earth who are come to propitiate his anger, to celebrate his greatness, or to solicit his protection. Now look on this picture, and then on that, and no man can say that the scene represented in the second is not the perfect consummation of that which was spoken in the first. There is God's handwriting among the nations. When you become acquainted with this handwriting, as it is written in the book of Daniel, it will be difficult to read the handwriting anywhere you find it. Will it be difficult to read the handwriting anywhere you find it in the history? Suppose in my handwriting, I write you a letter as long as the book of Daniel, without particular reference to the handwriting. You study that letter as you should study the book of Daniel. You become perfectly familiar with the handwriting. Then suppose that among some other parchments or documents, you find some sentence written in the same handwriting. Would you have any difficulty in recognizing it? Ballinger says from the audience, why not apply that to the question of education? The Spirit of God helped these great historians in writing the truth and helped them to find the truth and to retain it. And in reading those books, he promises to guide us into all the truth that there is in it. Jones replies, yes, God takes this gem of truth from the dust and rubbish where it is buried and sets it in God's own setting where it shines with its own luster. The Spirit of Prophecy does the same thing. He takes in the history of the Reformation, or the history of the Waldensians, for instance. He selects some of the scenes of those histories and takes them from that setting where not all is perfect truth and sets them over into the Lord's own setting where all is truth. There are statements that are true which God has led man to write. The Spirit of Prophecy picks out of surroundings that are not all true these gems of perfect truth, and sets them in the setting that is all true so that they can shine in their own true luster. Men have made objection to the Spirit of Prophecy. They would not do it if they knew what the Spirit of Prophecy is and where a quotation is found in the Spirit of Prophecy that has appeared in some other book. They would then ask, how is this any more than the Spirit of Prophecy than those books in which these facts are found? A passage in the history of the Reformation is quoted in Volume 4, for instance. They say that the book is no more inspiration than is the history of the Reformation, because in this book is found some of what appears in the history of the Reformation. The difference is in this. The Spirit of Prophecy in the mind which God is guiding by the direct inspiration of the Holy Spirit selects these scenes takes them up from surroundings that are not all true, where the truth is not clearly defined, and sets them in God's own setting, which is all truth. Take the quotation, for instance, that Paul makes in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. He says, "Evil communications corrupt good manners." That is a Greek sentence altogether. In the Greek writing, it was surrounded by a lot of things that there was no sense in it. They were all idolatry. The spirit of inspiration picked it up and placed it in God's own setting, where it appeared in all its native beauty. It was true before, now it is inspiration. But this is not to say that Paul was no more inspired than was the Greek writer. It does not say that the Greek writer was inspired as Paul was inspired. It does say that that truth came from God. God picked it out from its false setting and put it where it could be among all truth. Again, when Paul stood on Mars Hill, he spoke of the heathen around him and said, "Certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring." Now he makes it inspiration by saying that we are the offspring of God. God puts his endorsement upon that statement of the heathen poet that we are the offspring of God. But in the heathen poem in which it was written, it was surrounded with rubbish that had no truth in it and obscured its own true luster. Prescott says, "The Lord has picked out all the truth that is in the world and put it in the Bible." And Jones says, "Yes, that is so." And then Kellogg says, "It is not every true word. Is it not every true word an inspired word?" And Jones says, "Yes, it could not be otherwise, as it came from Christ, and he is the truth." And then J.A. Irwin closes by saying, "I want to say a word in the behalf of our stenographers. It seems to me that we must remember the golden rule, that these questions now come up prolong the time almost indefinitely. These men worked 14 solid hours yesterday, and if we want these reports to go to the bulletin, I think we will have to remember the golden rule. They are only men and cannot stand so much, and it seems to me, unless there's a manifest leading of the Spirit, we had better hold closely to the hours and quit on time." This is the end of Jones's sermon.